702 on 92.7 and 106 FM.
Streaming on 702.co.za.
The 702 app.
And on DStv channel 856.
It's The Money Show, and it's brought to you by Absa Access, an award-winning, secure, single sign-on platform that lets you manage your finances with speed and intelligence. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP. Welcome to The Money Show on this midweek madness, where we see the markets gain again, 1.6%, so still a better mark on that front. Across the show then this evening, we will be talking about CPI as that continues to head a little bit higher, a bit of a correction, I suppose, maybe. And we'll unpack what exactly has moved that. We also have our market update, but Bonang Mohale joins us on why South Africa needs to kickstart the economy through youth entrepreneurship. It feels like a sentiment we've continued to speak about all so often, and still nothing gets done. As we head towards COP26, it seems that gas emissions and all of that becomes a huge talking point. And more companies put out their pledges just as we head towards COP26. The climate change conference, of course, that'll be held out in the United Kingdom. So Sasol says they have the ambitious plan to reduce 20% of their emissions by 2030. We'll get to chat to Fleetwood Grobler, the president and CEO there. Our business unusual is the need for, to kind of get grid-scale batteries as we shift towards renewable energy. That conversation is quite important. Colin Cullis joins us for that one. Our consumer ninja is Wendy Nola, of course, and joins us this evening on a very interesting story. And our shapeshifter is Dion Geisa, the CEO of Liquid Telecoms.
Walking this talk together.
Every hour.
Every day. This is 702.
Let's walk the talk.
Now, not so long ago, we got a sense of how bad corruption could certainly be in South Africa. And it was really just sentiment from people saying that even under President Cyril Ramaphosa, things haven't necessarily gotten any better. And it seems that that has been justified to a large extent. The latest report then from Corruption Watch points towards an increase and an exposure of continued rot in public and private sectors. So let's talk to Melusi Nkala then, a researcher at Corruption Watch, just about this and a whole lot more. Melusi, thank you so much for the time. The numbers, I suppose, speak for themselves. Things are still as bad as they always have been.
Hi, Arabile. Yes, numbers do indeed speak for themselves, considering that last year, this time when we published this report, we were hitting almost 2,000 reports of corruption within the 1st of Jan to the end of June. So this time around, we have 1,964,000 reports of corruption. And the story is quite simple. It's that police corruption is leading with 12%. We've seen an increase in COVID-related corruption, which is at 8%. Schools is at 6%. And the public health care system is also featured there. But so too is the public housing sector. We've come in at 4%.
I mean, it's absolutely all alarming, right? And let's remember that you have things like food distribution parcels even happening in schools, even in public houses as well. Even all of that is actually still being, whether it be looted or corrupted in many ways as well. And it's really affecting a broader part of society, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I mean, that's the COVID-related issues, and that's where we see a lot of procurement-related corruption where companies are coming into play in a negative way, of course, where kickbacks are being paid to some of these companies. We've had a couple of incidents of companies claiming to be distributing or rolling out vaccines, but hundreds of millions of rand have gone missing. We've had incidents where companies, PPE.
Oh, Melusi, not sure if we've still got you there on the line. Are you still there? Okay, we seem to have just lost Melusi, unfortunately, there for some reason. So we'll try and get him back on the line a little bit later on to try and get more on that discussion. And one can certainly say that it's quite worrisome. 42% of the total reports came from the largest province, Gauteng, where Corruption Watch is located, followed then by KwaZulu-Natal and the Western Cape, 10 and 9% respectively, the Eastern Cape seeing a number of 7% out on that front. So vulnerability for whistleblowers too becomes a big question mark, because they now feel that they certainly can't necessarily, you know, blow the whistle on all of these aspects. It's so tough. And yet the corruption just continues. How long do we have to kind of wait for somebody to take accountability for this? President Cyril Ramaphosa ran on the ticket that corruption would be gone. He asked us to send him to Mamina. And yet, we still sit with 1,964 whistleblowers reporting acts of corruption in both the public and private sector. Nearly 2,000 cases that have been reported. That doesn't necessarily mean it's the full number, right? And it just takes a simple thing like COVID-19, for example, perhaps not simple as I noted, but just the pandemic in itself has massive numbers when it comes to the amount of corruption being put in place there. All sectors of society need to come together to make serious inroads in trying to at least tackle the corruption that occurs at pretty much every layer, every single layer there is of public and private authority in the country. It's going to be one thing that cannot be solved just off the cuff, but certainly is going to have to take some time. And one thing is going to have to, something's going to have to break at some point. Surely the tolerance levels are going to decrease at some point. We're headed now to November the 1st, right? So as we get to those elections, what do you vote for? Who do you vote for and why? And if you're voting to try and find some different answers, change of any sort, how sure are you that that's going to work out different as well? It's so difficult. And I think the fact that we still have so much corruption in this country enhances the misgivings and the unequal society that we've maintained for oh so long. At some point, President Cyril Ramaphosa, something needs to be done. Somebody has to be held accountable and heads need to roll.
702. Let's walk the talk.
Streaming countrywide on the 702 app.
Let's get into some economic data news now. Today, inflation came out at 4.9%. So price growth increasing a little bit above that midway point of the South African Reserve Bank's target range. It is up from that 4.6% number we saw out for July. Gina Schoeman is an economist at Citi and joins us now. Gina, thank you so much for the time. I suppose it doesn't necessarily shoot the lights out, does it? It is expected. So not really too much to write home about here.
Yes, not very much a surprise. I mean, we saw the petrol price come through. We also know that there's a low base effect from last year. And if you look at the number, almost the entire month-on-month inflation rate was driven up by the transport category. But I must say, if I look across the CPI basket, we are seeing little bits and pieces of it starting to move higher. We're starting to see an upward bias, you know, across a broad range of categories, which I wouldn't say something to really worry about as a consumer, because 4.9% is still historically low for South Africa. However, we need to be careful here. And I think the South Africa Reserve Bank will certainly be taking this into account.
Yeah, my big question would be the sustainability or the long-term effect then. I mean, does this mean that prices are going to head in this direction, or is there still some downside that we could see very soon?
Well, unfortunately, for the next couple of quarters, up until about the second quarter next year, we're expecting the CPI to remain around a 4.8-4.9% average. Thereafter, views are mixed. We think inflation is going to head lower to about 4%. However, the last forecast we got out of the South Africa Reserve Bank suggests that they think it's going to slow down, not as going to 4.5%. So it's all about, you know, what your views are in different categories. But I will say one thing, you know, we've got a very weak economy despite the rebound coming out of the COVID-19 crisis. So there's some elements of the basket where inflation's not going to be able to rise very quickly. But we have highlighted concerns in this economy about things such as administered prices, which today recorded a 10.3% year-on-year increase. So something absolutely needs to be done there.
Yeah, certainly does. Does this sort of paint a picture? And I mean, we all know the South African Reserve Bank doesn't necessarily look at historical data, but the trajectory is one that looks to be headed a little bit higher. Do they say tomorrow that they're beginning to look towards a moderation of the interest rate cycle and increase interest rates perhaps later on in the year?
Yes, we absolutely think so. We think that tomorrow's meeting will be about signaling their intent to raise rates again. But again, don't get too concerned. They've made it abundantly clear that they're not going to take interest rates back to the levels they were pre-COVID. In other words, when they're done with the hiking cycle, simply to normalize things, these interest rates will still be what they call accommodative. So it shouldn't put too much pressure on the consumer. So we think they're going to hike only by 25 basis points in November. And then again, later on, March next year looks the right timing at the moment, but it's very data dependent. Thereafter, things get very blurry because, well, what happens to South Africa, what happens to the global backdrop?
Yeah, what is perhaps a fair rate when it comes to those interest rates then, when it comes to the repo rate? 3.5%, of course, is far below where it usually is. Would you say 6% is perhaps where they're looking towards when we get to a normalized level, or are we still looking below that?
Well, I think it's also a function of inflation. So that's your nominal rate, your nominal neutral rate, as they would say. But it's also a function of inflation and where your real rate's going. But without getting too technical and confusing the issue here, we just think that the historical rate is now too high. You know, unless the U.S. rates start moving back to their historical rates, which are also unlikely to happen, there is no reason for South Africa to necessarily follow. So we think that from 3.5%, you know, at most you're going to head up to about 5%. But even then, to get up to 5%, you're going to need quite a stronger economy than what we have right now to be able to handle that. So they will take it slowly, and they've said they will. This is not going to be a hard and fast hiking cycle. So I think just listen to the South Africa Reserve Bank and watch inflation expectations.
Yeah. Well, it is the new normal, and even a new normal for South Africa's interest rates. Gina Skooman, thank you so much for the time. Economist at Citi joining us then as we talk about that inflation number as it heats up to 4.9%. The South African Reserve Bank set to announce its interest rates decision tomorrow.
Walking this talk together.
Every hour.
Every day. This is 702.
Let's walk the talk.
Now, the contested 2018 mining charter doesn't seem to be binding by law. What does this court ruling actually mean? The Gauteng Division of the High Court delivered that what was a unanimous decision today. It is a damning judgment declaring that the broad-based socio-economic empowerment charter for the mining and metals industry is simply policy and not actually legislation. It's not law. It's not binding. Peter Leon, co-chair for Africa and partner at Herbert Smith Freehills South Africa, joins us on the line to get to grips with this one a little bit. Peter, what does this actually mean then? I mean, does this nullify sort of any agreements that have been set out in accordance with the 2018 mining charter?
No, I don't think it does. Good evening. But it's a very, very important decision because it vindicates a view I've long held, which is the mining charter is simply a statement of policy which influences the grant of any mining right. And obviously when the Department of Mineral Resources and Energy grants a right, they have to take into account the applicant's empowerment credentials in accordance with the mining charter, and the right is, you know, is awarded on the basis of that. But what happened, when one goes back in history, when the original charter came out back in October 2002, it was a very simple document. It wasn't drafted by... It was basically a sort of an undertaking between government, labor, and industry to bring about socioeconomic transformation in the mining industry. But because it was fairly vaguely worded, when the second mining charter came out in 2010, the government decided to tighten up all the empowerment and related objectives and made it much more of a regulatory instrument. And that was taken even further in 2018, where you have provisions in the mining charter of 2018, which says that 80% of services and 70% of goods have to be procured from South African companies, 21% of those have to be owned by historically disadvantaged people, and so on and so forth. So what happened, you know, through a sort of sleight of regulatory hand over the last nearly 20 years is the charter has become more and more of a regulatory instrument. So what the court, the High Court, said in this unanimous judgment, it's a very strong judgment. I think it's going to be difficult to set it aside on appeal, and I've no doubt the department will appeal, is that this is the, all the mining charter is a policy document. It was originally a compact between government, labor, and business, the mining industry obviously representing business, but it should not be seen as a regulatory instrument, and it's not subordinate legislation. So that's the import and impact of it.
I mean, how much does this sort of hurt then the Department of Mineral Resources here to say to themselves, well, we had put out this document, Gwede Mantashe had tried to steamroll this as well ahead quite massively to ensure that there's some sense of stability. We still have instability, I suppose, in South Africa's mining segment. And yes, not all provisions of the charter were reviewed and set aside, but it still creates a massive imbalance, right?
No, well, I actually think that the judgment's very good for the rule of law, to be honest. I mean, I think it will promote stability rather than create instability. I think it will make investors a lot happier about the regulatory environment in this country. Obviously, the question is, you know, does the department appeal? I suspect they will. They're either going to have to get leave from the High Court. Bear in mind, this is a unanimous judgment by a full bench, i.e. three judges. Yeah. So the court would have to give them leave, or they have to get leave from the Supreme Court of Appeal. I think leave would probably be granted. So I suppose that does create a certain amount of uncertainty. But, you know, if this judgment is upheld on appeal, it's actually good for the industry. And I think what the judgment has done is made it very clear what the charter is and what it isn't. And all the issues we've had about, you know, having to re-empower rights, you can't transfer rights or, you know, do anything else with them, you know, without re-empowering yourself by increasing the empowerment requirements from 26% to 30%, all that's gone out the window. And, I think that what it does do is promote regulatory certainty, and I think that's to be welcomed. It also shows, you know, again, that we have a strong rule of law in this country and the courts are independent and impartial.
Yeah. Peter, certainly, look, what we've needed is stability, a continuation of policy, and perhaps just an outright statement, whatever that statement is, that we follow through on it and we make sure that the rules and law is certainly binding in this context. Unfortunately, that is all we have time for. But thank you so much for speaking to us this evening. Peter Leon is co-chair for Africa and partner at Herbert Smith Freehills, South Africa, as we talk the mining charter.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
Chris Stewart, portfolio manager at 91, joins us for this market unpacking today. 1.6% higher goes the JSE. The big question, though, will certainly be the Federal Reserve this evening. Hey, Chris.
Yeah, good evening, Arabile. Yeah, we've got the FOMC decision coming out today, and that's certainly going to be a driver of market sentiment later on in the US trading session and into our session tomorrow. As well as the ongoing saga around Evergrande and the Chinese property sector, which I think will continue to feature strongly tomorrow, given that they've got a payment on their US bond due tomorrow. It'll be interesting to see if they manage to service that or not. So those are going to be the big drivers of the market. And certainly today, some positive news around Evergrande, the fact that they serviced some of their domestic local currency debt commitments seems to have allayed some concern short-term, and we've seen a strong kick across the commodity complex today, across emerging market currencies, and indeed across the equity market.
Did we overreact to the Evergrande element? Yes, fine, they have a massive debt that is bigger than the debt of some countries, $300 billion. But, you know, so many people have actually said that, one, the Chinese authorities have themselves got the mechanisms to be able to help out Evergrande, and they wouldn't need to necessarily have this huge contagion effect. And, you know, it wasn't necessarily going to be as bad, but we all looked at it and thought this could become another financial crisis.
Yeah, I mean, it's Evergrande is certainly a current catalyst. Clearly, there's some concerns that, you know, equity markets have been going up for a long time. Monetary accommodation has to end at some stage. Do we see, risk assets able to continue to go up in a more normalized policy environment? And, you know, does Evergrande become the catalyst? I don't know. It certainly, I would imagine that the Chinese authorities will do everything in their power for, you know, an issue like this not to become something systemic.
Sure.
They will, in all likelihood, provide the support required in order to prevent that from happening. But again, the broader question is is there a transition in the rate of growth in the Chinese economy coming?
Sure.
And if the Chinese economy slows down, even if it doesn't slow down due to some, you know, catastrophic type of event, such as a property market crisis in China, you know, what sort of impact does that have on the rest of the world, given that China has been you know, a big driver of global demand for commodities for many, many, many years.
Yeah, Chris, let's get into some company news then. I mean, Spar comes out with an update. It seems then that things in that retail space do continue to try head forward. I mean, it wasn't massively affected during COVID, but of course, incomes dwindled a little bit, and that may be a worry for them later.
Yeah, I mean, the Spar trading update came out today, the 48-week sales update. So for the vast bulk of the financial year that they'll be reporting on to the end of September. And, you know, it's a bit of a mixed bag, I think. On the margin, probably a little bit disappointing. The international businesses, certainly in Switzerland and in Ireland, seem to have been going okay. What stood out to me was the domestic groceries business, where it does look as though they've been losing quite a lot of market share in domestic groceries of late, growing quite a lot slower than their the larger supermarket chains, if you like, food grocery chains, the ShopRites and Pick and Pays of this world. It does look as though Spar has slowed down somewhat. Is that a function of changing behavior as individuals have become slightly more confident? Maybe they're shopping at the bigger malls, shopping with the bigger franchises rather than, you know, sticking to the regional malls and doing their shopping at the Spars of this world. But, you know, if I had one question for them, it's what exactly is going on in your domestic grocery business, because it does look to have underperformed peers of late.
Yeah, very quickly, 66% jump to 2.8 billion rand is the headline earnings figure for Remgro. It's up 3% today on the stock exchange. Some recovery there at least.
Yeah, I mean, the earnings numbers have been pre-announced at Remgro. The dividend, if anything, I think shareholders will probably say the dividend's a little bit disappointing. The outlook was somewhat cautious. It's going to be interesting. I mean, Remgro's in the process of reinventing itself. I think they've recognized that attracting a 35% discount to net asset value is not where they want to be, and they need to create a unique portfolio that's not replicable through the listed property market. We've seen them unbundle their RMH shares. There's activity taking place at RMI at the moment. They're going to be direct recipients of shares in Momentum Metropolitan as well as Discovery, which I imagine they will probably also rid themselves of in the fullness of time. You've got Distell potential corporate action coming up with Heineken. So there's a lot going on at Remgro, and I think they're going to be looking quite carefully at how can they craft a portfolio that perhaps is somewhat more unique than what they've had in the past, and in some way unlock that very deep discount to net asset value at which they currently trade.
Chris Stewart, appreciate the time. Thank you so much for joining us as we unpack that market picture. 1.6% better off is the JSE All Share to close out this Wednesday trading picture. It is a shortened week on the local index as well, so we'll see how things fare tomorrow as we take in some of the Federal Reserve's decision as it comes out at 8 p.m. South African time.
The Money Show is brought to you by APSA Access, an award-winning, secure, single sign-on platform that lets you manage your finances with speed and intelligence. That's Africanacity. APSA is a registered FSP.
My name is Arabile Komete, standing in for Bruce Whitfield. On the next Money Show, we will be analyzing the Reserve Bank's decision on interest rates as inflation has passed their midpoint target. The owner of Rocco Mama's, Spur, will also give us and take us through the company's financial results. And personal finance expert Warren Ingram will talk about spring cleaning your finances at least once a year.
Walking this talk together.
Every hour.
Every day. This is 702.
Let's walk the talk.
While we certainly have one of the largest unemployment rates globally, at least of 82 countries, followed at least by Bloomberg News, it means that a large part of society is certainly without work. And it even means that youth unemployment is the highest in the world too. But how else do we then thrive as an economy if the people who are meant to aid the future don't even have jobs to be able to do so? Bonang Mohale is the chair at Bidvest and joins us now to talk about why kickstarting the economy through youth entrepreneurship is going to be absolutely empirical. And even critical, really, for South Africa's growth. Ndate Bonang-Mohale, thank you so much for the time. Really appreciate it. The finance minister yesterday spoke about industrialization and how South Africa had de-industrialized over the last few years, and it's time to create more industries. But doing so without the youth is going to mean nothing. Am I correct?
Arabile, my brother, thank you for having me. Actually, it gets worse because we inherited an infrastructure that relatively works. All we had to do was just maintain it, planned and preventative maintenance. So in the mining industry, we had almost 1 million jobs. Today, as we speak, 400,000 jobs. We used to be the number one gold-producing country in the world. Now we're not even in the top five. When the first super commodity cycle came, and driven mostly by demand of coal by China, we couldn't even meet that demand because our supply chain was broken, and they ended up getting coal from South America. So when you have young people, women and men of military age, who are not gainfully employed, not only are you asking for trouble, you are actively inviting it. The figures are actually quite disturbing. So some people are celebrating to say 2 weeks ago, Stats SA tells us that we have positive GDP growth of 1.2%. Of course, we will take it. But remember, Arabi, population growth is 1.6%, which means we are going backwards. But the Minister of Finance talking about the awaited GDP numbers and CPI numbers. Mm. Let's just do some crude arithmetic. So if interest rates are about 6%, CPI is midpoint, 3%, it stands to reason that the GDP growth must be at least 3 percentage points. Otherwise, we are going backwards.
Yeah.
Because for the last 10 years, your and my discretionary purchasing power and therefore disposable income has actually been eroding. But the worrying thing is that it's a jobless growth, the same way that we had during President Thabo Mbeki's 43 consecutive quarters of positive GDP growth. Unemployment figures of young people is a ticking time bomb at 74.9%, which means 10 million young people are not in education, employment, or training. But also, remember, in those figures of positive GDP growth, three things are not included. The 2 weeks in July of rampant looting, Transnet's cyber attack, but also the port of Durban being rated the third from the bottom, all of those are still going to be included in the quarter three figures. And look where the growth is coming from, in financial services, not where young people are employed in large numbers, but in this broad category, which for now I will call financial services, not in mining, agriculture, manufacturing, not even in tourism and hospitality, where women are employed in large numbers, nor even in ICT. Lastly, Arabile, remember that in those months, June, July, we still had Eskom's rolling blackouts. When that happens, the country loses anything between 1 and 2 billion rand. It wipes off an entire percentage point from the GDP. Arabile, I'm back to you.
It begs the question then as to, as an economy that tries to grow, as a country that continues to try and be the bedrock of Africa in terms of investments as well, how exactly are we getting this so wrong when we knew, we've known what actually needs to be done? We're very good at creating the plans, where we can easily create the plans. I mean, if we were to do another plan right now, I'm sure we'd be able to bring one out in 2 days. But right now, even the reconstruction and review plan that President Cyril Ramaphosa had tried to institute not so long ago, even that is still moving in a backward trajectory. How do we plug the hole? How do we start, at the very least, with just getting things right?
Absolutely right, my dear brother. So the first thing is to act like Alcoholics Anonymous and accept that we've got a problem. Two, all the social partners must look at the same data and say, we are so deep in the hole that there's no further lower to go, therefore let's stop digging. Thirdly, as all the social partners, we then need to agree on 10 things that needs to be done, but focus on 3, no more than 4. Because if we try to do all 10 of them, we won't do anything. And part of accepting that we've got a problem says we are now holding world records for all the wrong things. We are the most unequal society in the world. In your intro, you said we have the highest unemployment rate in the world as per the 80-odd countries measured by Bloomberg. Thirdly, we have the highest failure rate of SMEs in the world. If I were to add, I would say the second highest suicide rate in the world after Russia.
Yeah.
So yeah. Practically what we want to do is with EmpowerWorks, we have embarked on this thing that is called Empower Youth from the 3rd to the 9th of October, and we are taking it where it's needed the most, in Orange Farm. You see, Orange Farm is the largest informal settlement, but the rapidly growing township. It has approximately 85% of its people that work in Johannesburg. But you see, it's emblematic, and it's a microcosm of the broader South Africa, because most of its people use trains to go to work, and youth unemployment is reflective of the entire population. But you see, Orange Farm falls within one of only 2 areas where the Human Development Index is below that of the city of Johannesburg, where almost 80% of its people work. In that HDI index, it combines 3 basic dimensions, which is 1, long and healthy life; 2, knowledge; 3, decent standard of living. And yet, more than 80% of its population earn below the poverty datum line. So geographically displaced from the business districts of Greater Johannesburg, Orange Farm is largely a marginalized dormitory area.
Yeah,
with zero economic base of its own, it is dependent on its people waking up every morning and going to look for work somewhere else.
Sure.
So what we're trying to do is to simply say, one, let's create our own companies and hire our own children.
Yes.
Because it is madness to continue to make babies and then you send them to a different neighborhood where they go down on their knees begging for a job from somebody else, when we as parents, it's actually our job. Because the future of South Africa is heavily invested by these young people, because that's where they're going to spend most of their time in. South Africa is currently faced with an unacceptably high unemployment rate and all the maladies that accompany that. So we are saying Empower Youth Transformation Week. We want to offer sustainable and practical outcomes that are transformative. Because, Arabile, if they can hug, engage, interact, and interface with the chairman of the BBS group and the chancellor of the University of the Free State, these kids say, if Bonang, who comes from Katlong, can do it,
yes,
I can do so too. 100%. When I was in school, we had a guy called Tsepiso, who was a male nurse. In that year alone, 35 out of 120 matriculants went and took up nursing, and all of them were males.
Oh, wow.
You can't miss what you don't know,
yes.
Arabi.
Yeah, 100%. Bonang Mohale, always great having a chat with you. I think, if anything, it details just where we need to be, how we need to grow as a country, and what exactly the steps are that we need to be able to develop far beyond the levels that we've gotten ourselves to right now, right? Our economy sits in a situation where even at the bottom, we don't have anything. Youth entrepreneurship is going to have to be a critical rollout. We don't need textbook answers anymore. We need actual physical groundwork in order to move the needle when it comes to South Africa's economic future.
Walking this talk together.
Every hour.
Every day. This is 702.
Let's walk the talk.
It's about 6 minutes till the top of the hour then. We've also gotten some interesting company news still to have come out today. Sasol announcing its ambitious plans then to reduce its emissions as well. And as we head towards COP26, One thing's for sure is we're getting a lot of news when it comes to the gas emission stories and just how we can create a sustainable solutions environment, I suppose, across the board. Fleetwood Grobler is the president and CEO at Sasol and joins us on the line now. Fleetwood, thank you so much for the time. Appreciate it. Let's talk just about, just how much you wanted to reduce this by and the sustainability thereof, I suppose. 25 billion rand at most is certainly a sizable figure here.
Yes, good evening, Arabili, and welcome to talk about this around what we announced today. So it is quite an investment. We range the cost to be between 15 to 25 billion rand that needs to be invested in the time frame between 2024 and 2027-28 for us to realize this ambition. It is going to be a substantial reduction if we look at the 30% of our baseline for our South African value chain and our international chemicals business. That translates to almost 20 million tons of CO2 that will be reduced by doing pursuing this target that we think we will be realizing by 2030.
Yeah, and I suppose in all of this, it's one of those things where as we head towards COP26, more and more pledges being set out. In some way, some might say you don't want to be left behind, but this offers a greater and sustainable business for shareholders too, doesn't it?
Yes, of course. And I think that, our ambition to get to net zero by 2050 is even taking it quite a bit further in terms of what happens beyond 2030. And that is the period where we believe the cost of renewables and green hydrogen and sustainable carbon sources will really come into play. We are not predicting is it 2020, 2034, 2040, or what is the exact time frame, but we know for sure that with the recent announcements with respect to focus on reducing the cost of green hydrogen as well as renewables, that is bound to happen. And I think we just need to watch the space. But we will be ready to implement in a very phased manner and an incremental manner to start off with green hydrogen and sustainable carbon sources into our facilities over time, commencing around 2030 timeframe and beyond.
Have you needed to be very careful with the amount of money you spend and where you spend it as well, considering that it wasn't just so long ago that you really were caught in quite a difficult situation financially? Has that, number one, been eased somewhat, considering oil prices, of course, continuing to head higher, your share price as well going up quite substantially since those days too? Do you feel like you're at least in the green as you try to, reduce your greenhouse gas emissions?
Yes, so we would see the journey to be in two phases. So if I look at the current phase that we're in, we are resetting the company. We are resetting, Sasol 2.0 to get us a resilient cash flows in an oil price environment of $55 real. We know oil prices are higher than this, but the market remains volatile, and we think long term, our view of oil price is much lower than the current prices. And to be prepared for that, that's why we implemented Sasol 2.0, and we've communicated our targets to the market to really reduce our fixed costs, to unlock additional gross margin, and to focus our sustenance capital spend in the range of $20 to $25 billion per annum, billion rand rather, per annum. And I think that is enabling us in the next, when we deliver that, that's enabling us the cash flow pools to be able to implement this transition by self-funding through our own cash flows in the realms of that magnitude of 15 to 25 billion.
We certainly will be watching. This space is quite an interesting one of late and has certainly played out quite interestingly. And it seems that more and more announcements are certainly being made in and around the globe. Sasol planning to reduce 20% of its emissions by 2030. That's the CEO and president at Sasol, Fleetwood Grobler.
702
on 92.7 and 106 FM.
Streaming on 702.co.za.
The 702 app.
And on DStv channel 856.
The Money Show is brought to you by APSA Access, an award-winning secure single sign-on platform that lets you manage your finances with speed and intelligence. That's African Asset. Absa is a registered FSP. It's the second hour of The Money Show. My name is Arabile Kumete, standing in for Bruce Whitfield on this Wednesday evening. A little bit earlier on in the show, we had spoken about inflation going up to 4.9%, how the mining charter from 28, the contested mining charter that is not binding by law and perhaps offers a little bit more clarity, in fact, is the word from Peter Leon, who is co-chair for Africa and a partner at Herbert Smith Freehills South Africa. New corruption report exposing that there is a continued rot in public and private sectors. The corruption basis that President Cyril Ramaphosa has always campaigned on seems to have fallen flat. In fact, things have possibly gotten even worse. And South Africa needs to kickstart its economy, perhaps through youth entrepreneurship. That is certainly word from Bonang Mohale, the chair at Bidvest. And of course, Sasol also getting that gas emissions story into play as well. They plan to reduce their emissions by at least 20% by 2030. In fact, we'll continue in a similar vein then as we kick off the second hour of the show with our Business Unusual.
The Money Show.
Business Unusual with Colin Cullis.
Colin Cullis joins us then as we get into our Business Unusual this evening. It's a good evening to you, Colin. So the need then for grid-scale batteries is intensifying as we shift to renewable energy. Now, what exactly does that mean? I mean, I've always asked the question why we continue to just use lithium as part of our batteries. Is that really the element we're speaking about here? And also, why?
Hi, Arabile. Yes, it is. And a bit like some years ago, you know, when all of the development and innovation seemed to be happening around mobile phones, every year there was a new massive improvement in them, until finally they reach a plateau and then not much goes on. Well, it's the energy sector now, and more specifically the renewable energy sector, that has had that sort of ramp up of innovation and testing methods that were, you know, they're not unknown methods. They've all been tested and shown to have promise in a laboratory. But there wasn't really a commercial reason for somebody to try and scale them up and try and get them, you know, commercialized and industrialized to be able to handle them at these sorts of scales. So with renewables, they're fantastic at generating, and these days even better at generating, energy at lower and lower costs. This is sort of typically wind and solar. But the catch for them has always been that they typically generate electricity at their peak during the day when demand is usually lowest, and don't generate as much or anything when the peaks happen early in the morning and late in the evenings. That results in what's known as this duck curve, the two little plot lines that they have when you have energy demand plotted as a peak in the morning and the afternoon.
Yeah.
And the inverse of that has been a peak in the middle of the day when the renewables go. And supposedly the shape you get between the two is this duck curve. Well, the plan for being able to overcome this is to say, well, if you can't generate electricity in the early morning or late at night with wind and solar, is there a way you can store it? And in the past with fossil fuels, we have a need to store energy because the fossil fuels were incredibly cheap. The power stations were baseload, i.e. they ran all the time. So there was no real need for us to have a storage of energy. We simply generated it, used it, and if we didn't need it, we kind of just let it go back into the ground.
Yeah.
But now that now those things are changing. One, we need to be mindful of the amount of carbon we're pushing out. And two, we need to get a lot cleverer about making sure that the power is available, not just all the time, but in the areas where it's needed. And I read a press release today that made me go, it was from a large industrial company that was announcing a 70 megawatt solar project to secure its industrial operations in Limpopo. That bit is good. Renewable source of energy to protect its industrial operations in Limpopo. The bit that made me go, is that the industrial operation was looking to secure with clean, sustainable, reliable energy was a coal mine that was contracted to Eskom. A little topsy-turvy when that's the way you secure the energy network. But it does go to show that the shift is happening and it's probably going to start accelerating. And so what I thought I'd look at this evening is an update on previous conversations I've had around that storage part. Lithium-ion, as you rightly point out, is the go-to best-in-class we have at the moment. It's not to say it'll be the overall best battery option, but it's the one that's had the most testing, the most advances, and now commercially probably the one that's most deployed at scale. It is fantastic for power density and fantastic for power delivery.
But it doesn't last. Its power capacity is a bit of a problem. And it is very expensive when you really start scaling it up into massive amounts. And as the world shifts to be using a lot more lithium for cars, phones, and just about anything else that is using batteries these days, there is going to be a bit of a pinch on its supply and the means by which we acquire it. So this is where other batteries have come into the mix as well. Other chemical-based ones. I looked at the flow batteries, which may be a fantastic opportunity for South Africa because the best version so far is a vanadium flow battery. And vanadium is mined, or it's part of the additional stuff that comes out of the ground when we typically mine for iron, or certainly South Africa's reserve of iron tends to have a good percentage of vanadium in it. Otherwise, it is very expensive to mine on its own. So potentially South Africa would be able to make an opportunity with that. Eskom does have a couple of these that they're busy testing, or at least one that they're busy testing to see how reliable it'll be, how easy it is to build at scale and operate. It is very good for being very, very big. It can handle massive capacity. And unlike lithium, which does have a bit of a lifespan issue, these can be, you know, cycled and charged and depleted many, many thousands of times over. The catch with them, though, is that the chemicals that they use in them can be, you know, they require some careful care. You can't just have anybody getting access to it. And they need to show their reliability over time. They're also not that great for delivering energy very quickly. So if a grid drops or if there's a fault on the line, typically you wouldn't rely on these kinds of batteries to fill in. That's where lithium ion is still the best. Then the other category are the so-called mechanical types. The best one we know is things like pump storage. So these are dams that have hydroelectric systems built into it. Effectively, the dam is the battery. Then other ones that have started looking quite interesting are the gravity, the similar gravity ones. And there's some that use a heavy weight attached to a long cable. And when you have energy, use a motor to winch the cable up and lift the weight. And then when you need the energy, you simply drop the weight. And as it drops, it drives a turbine and generates electricity. And the use case that could be quite useful for South Africa is potentially to hang these very, very large and heavy weights in the old, very deep, disused gold mines on the South African, you know, in the gold reef area. And that potentially could certainly get us out of a pinch should we need it. Again, they're not going to be instant energy, but they're the kind of energy that when you need to release it, it'll release a nice steady amount and potentially for quite a long period of time. The other ones are float batteries. They work sort of as the inverse. You take a buoyant thing and you pull it under the water. And then when you need the energy, you release it. And as the float gets pushed up to the surface, it generates electricity. This one is also a mechanical battery, and it comes from somebody with a fantastic pedigree for potentially looking to create something new. The company's name is called Steesdal, and it's headed by the man Hendrik Steesdal, not a name like an Elon Musk or Thomas Edison that maybe we should know a little more about, because back in the late 70s, early 80s, this is a Dane who helped us design what a modern wind turbine looks like, from the way of conceiving how to create the gears, to improving what the blades and how the blades work, to getting rid of the gearboxes altogether for effectively what is now our modern wind turbines. He has, I don't know, something like 600 patents or something for refining it. And he's now changed his focus from looking after how to improve the generation of electricity to its storage. And the best way I can describe this model is it uses hot rocks. A completely bonkers sort of idea when you describe it like that. But for the science that's involved, certainly something we've been aware of and been able to do for quite some time. The test now is, can we get it to scale? Can we get it to the capacity needs? And can we bring it in on costs that allow it to compete, certainly with the likes of coal plants and other things? So here's basically how it works. You take two very large cylinders. Well, the size of the cylinders depends on the capacity you want, but generally speaking, you're probably going to need quite a large cylinder with enough space for air to be pumped in and compressed to a certain pressure. But inside that cylinder, you need some or other rock material. Now, the rocks are principally to deal with a small problem in science that says air is both a fairly good conductor of heat. It can flow and it's compressible. It's not as good a conductor of heat as liquids. And while liquids can flow, they're not compressible. And, you know, unfortunately, solids are neither flowable, they don't flow, and they're not compressible. So using heat and these rocks is a good way to say, use the air to flow and carry the heat, and then the stones themselves to be able to absorb the heat and sustain it. And the great thing about rocks is that they can be heated to significant temperatures and remain completely inert. They're not going to change shape. They're not going to melt. They're not going to explode. They're not going to do any of those things. Well, depending on the rocks you use, and they're looking to try and find now the optimum kind of stone to use. Basalt seems to be a popular option. And then, of course, the size of those stones. You don't want a little bit of sand, and you don't want something maybe that's as big as one big rock. You take your excess energy and you put it into a compressor. That compressor is going to heat the air simply by pressurizing it. And heating that air gets pushed into a cylinder filled with these rocks and heated up to a temperature just over 600 degrees. And that's you primed your first system. While you're filling that system, the air that's getting pushed out at the bottom goes through a heat exchanger to reduce the temperature of the air, as well as through a special kind of expander. And these expander turbines lower the temperature by expanding the pressure and reduce the temperature down to minus 30 degrees. So in the one tank, you've got hot rocks heated and pressurized to over 600 degrees. And in the other tank, you've got very cold rocks and chilled air down to minus 30 degrees. That temperature differential is a very big part for what helps drive the efficiency of this battery. When you want to take that energy out of the battery, you discharge the hot air. It goes through that heat exchanger and drives a turbine, which gives you the electricity. And that whole process then also chills the air down and pushes it back at a not quite minus 30 degrees, but to about 70 degrees back into the first chamber, while the top chamber clears out and goes into the over 600 degrees chamber, which will reduce back down to about 300 degrees. That's the sort of neutral state for the two chambers. Yeah. Then when you've got electricity again, you add it back in, heat up the one side and chill the other. The great thing about that system, it's a closed system. It can be redone over and over and over again with what they claim to be about 60% efficiency, with an added benefit of also that heat exchanger will provide you with natural heat. So you can then use that heat for warming greenhouses, warming homes, anything else that might need a bit of heat to generate, or put back into the actual heating system up in the top if that's going to be useful for the purposes. Sure. Yeah. Now, it is still new technology. It needs to be proven. But the reason I raise it is because in South Africa, where there is a great need for us to improve our ability to generate energy and to make a lot more energy available for South Africans who still lack the access.
Sure.
The challenge at the moment is it's either fossil fuels, which are they are the cheapest that we have, or to look at alternatives like gas, which are great for a short-term get-you-out-of-trouble thing, but I'm not so sure it's a good idea to be investing 20 years for that as a solution. That looks like it's going to be overtaken by what renewables and batteries can do. And while I think nuclear is a very good and clean energy option, it too can't compete with the likely for innovation and cost drops and the time it takes to build. You can build a power plant that, even if it's wrong, even if it's overtaken in 5 years with the technology, could probably still pay for itself, be dismantled and replaced, than having to commit to many, many years building a nuclear power station. So hopefully those combination of things, I'll put a bit more details online for people to have a look at. This is an ongoing conversation about the unusual but hopefully remarkable work that is happening for creating better batteries to save humanity from our carbon future.
Certainly is very interesting. I keep saying that as we head towards COP26, it seems like all of these relevant issues certainly keep coming up. And this is indeed one of them, as we talk about just the storage is going to be so critical to get right. Because if we can do so, then it just makes generating that power a little bit easier to do, because you then know where to store it on a longer term basis. Colin Cullis, appreciated that for our Business Unusual, talking about batteries as we get into renewable energy.
The Money Show.
Consumer Ninja.
Our Consumer Ninja, Wendy Nola, joins us then as we get into this segment of the show this evening. Wendy, good evening to you. A very interesting case here that we make note of, one involving FNB that was handed down in the Mafikeng High Court. Let's unpack it very quickly. What happened to Mr. Godfrey Getile from Freiburg?
Okay. Hi, Arbile. Look, we probably need half an hour to go into this properly, but I'll try and distill it down to the essence and the little time we have.
Sure.
It just caught my interest. It's because it's really curious. So the bank, if it be sought an order against one of its clients, Mr. Godfrey Getile of Freiburg, in the amount of just shy of 3 million rand, if you don't mind, plus interest of 10% per annum. Plus, they wanted the payment of the bank's legal costs on an attorney and client scale. So essentially, Khatile says he was the victim of cybercrime. He responded to one of those phishing emails and gave the fraudster his banking details. And they ended up taking certain amounts out of his bank account, totaling 3 million rand. He says he didn't see the money. He was the victim of, probably, you know, stupidly handed over his details, but there was no money in his account and there was no credit facility on his the account that he opened with FNB back in 2020. It was a smart account. It was, there was absolutely no credit facility, but still the money went. And over, obviously completely over and above his transaction limits daily and weekly, whatever. Anyway, but the bank said no. He either... He contravened his the terms and conditions of his contract and that he didn't report it within those amounts within 30 days, but his bank statement didn't reveal it within the 30 days. And they said he handed over his details to a third party, which he shouldn't have done. Or they said he was actually in on the fraud and that the accounts, the third parties to which the money was paid, were, he was in cahoots with, and he was enriched, so the legal word goes. And it ended up in court. I mean, this happened in 2015, Arabile, and it made its way to court. Well, finally, a judgment was handed down about 3 weeks ago. The bank said he was grossly negligent or alternately, as I say, acted fraudulently. And there was just some curious plot twists, like... as I said, the unlawful payments, so they called, didn't reflect on his statement. They happened October 2015, but they only reflected on his statement at the end of November 2015 and during December of 2015. The bank said its computer software, which normally blocks unlawful payments being processed, experienced a failure and wasn't functioning during that term. Long story short, Khatile's response was that in 2015, at the time, he was unemployed, had no monthly income, was doing odd jobs to survive, and he went into a classic situation. He went into an internet cafe in Freiburg in the Northwest, checked his emails, and he found there was a pop-up screen with a message reflecting that he'd won a certain amount of money in foreign currency. You know the story, Arabile. So he clicked on it, and then he got a call from a woman calling herself Ilana and said she was his account manager and they were going to send this money through. And he gave her what she asked for, a copy of his ID, proof of residence, his banking details. He didn't get the money, though. The woman insisted that the money had been deposited and later on discovered that this money had gone and the bank wanted it from him. The upshot, we've only got a couple of minutes left, Judge Andre Peterson found that the bank's evidence fell, what he called, gravely shy of proving that the carelessness of Khatile was the real direct or immediate cause of the bank having been misled. They said on the bank's own version, the respondent had no funds in his account, plus his account didn't have any credit facility, and that it was the bank's imperative to question and contact the respondent in terms of its obligations in the agreement to raise the red flag on those transactions before making payment. The bank's computer systems being down during October 2015 and prior to the respondent bringing his account out of a dormant state, that was another part of the story, can't be relegated to a mere error, the judge said. It's clear that the so-called error points to a compromised computer system where all of the bank's clients appear to have been at risk. And essentially, the bank was clearly careless in relation to the non-avoidance of the loss it sustained and is accordingly non-suited both on its own failure to comply with the terms of the agreement and the bank's carelessness was clearly the proximate cause of the loss it sustained. So basically, it was a sorry for you, FNB. You can't claim this 3 million rand from Khatile. And their claim was dismissed. As for costs, he said, well, having regard to the issues, and with due regard to the carelessness of the bank, FNB, as well as the respondent in giving over all his accounts details to a stranger, it would be fair and just that no order be made as to costs. But
all
what an interesting
due
one.
To just
3 million
cyber
rand
crime.
Gone out of the account, but he never had it in his account in the first place. So how did the bank, it wasn't credit, but I just found it quite a fascinating case.
It is so fascinating.
In an era of mass bank fraud going on all over the place. But yeah, Getile lives to not have to pay 3 million rand to FNB.
Phew, I can tell you that much, that a bill of 3 million rand that you don't know where it came from.
Imagine, boy, plus interest.
Oh boy, sure, thank goodness for that one. Wendy, thank you so much for this one. Our consumer ninja, Wendy Nola, joining us then this evening. A very interesting case on that one.
The Money Show is brought to you by APSA Access, an award-winning secure single sign-on platform that lets you manage your finances with speed and intelligence. That's Africanacity. APSA is a registered FSP.
The Money Show.
Shapeshifters.
Our shapeshifter this evening is Dion Geyser, the CEO of Liquid Intelligent Technologies. Thank you so much for joining us this evening, Dion. I hope you're well.
I am, thank you. How are you doing?
Fantastic. Cannot complain. Am I saying it correctly? Is it Geyser? I mean, I had an argument a little bit earlier on, just with regards to...
Yeah,
and surely it can't be
Geyser.
So it is Geyser. Okay, great stuff. So congratulations, number one, I suppose, on number one being called or being put forward as CEO at Liquid Telecom. It must have been something you looked at and thought to yourself, yes, I can do the job, but it's certainly not going to be an easy one, considering especially where the telecoms market is in South Africa.
Yeah, I think what really intrigued me about the role is, a couple of, key aspects of the business that we have as Liquid Intelligent Technologies. Maybe a bit of a background, right? Liquid Telecoms, as you've just called it, has got a long history in South Africa. It came actually from the background of being part of Transtel, which became Neotel, or the second national operator. And in 2017, Liquid Group actually acquired Neotel. And since then, we've rebranded to Liquid Telecoms in 2017. Now, if you follow the recent journey and part of my arrival as CEO in the business at the start of this year is being driven around the fact that, as Liquid, we've taken a large transformation step to pivot from Liquid Telecoms into Liquid Intelligent Technologies. And that's what really excited me about the opportunity to join the team. Not only do we have a great aspirational, executive group leadership team, we operate companies across 15 countries across the continent. But, as a group and specifically in South Africa, we've got a phenomenal asset base, my 20 years in the ICT industry has led me to really understand that, underlying assets is really what drives value for the future generation of our ICT companies. And if we have the ability to add on top of that related services that we as Liquid Intelligent Technologies are looking at offering in the market around cloud services, cybersecurity, managed services, it provides a fantastic opportunity for us, to leapfrog into future technologies. And that's what really excited me about the role. I like the opportunities of taking a company from A to B and, transforming what we have inside of that to where the market needs to be.
And as you said, it's also going to then be about what it is exactly as a product that you offer that is entirely different from your competitors. Do you think the market itself is getting oversaturated at some point, or is there still enough growth, enough room to kind of move things along and change even how people see certain telecoms entities?
I think that's a very relevant question, right? Because if you look at the traditional telco businesses, and maybe for some understanding, again, to our business today as Liquid Intelligent Technologies, we actually took a step a couple of years back to start investing into cloud services, data center infrastructure, on top of the network assets of fiber and related assets, in the country. And what was quite clear at the start of the pandemic last year is that, the demand for cloud services increased significantly, and with that, of course, the related cybersecurity threats that increased globally. And as a group executive team, the decision was taken to fast-track Liquid Telecom's transition into Liquid Intelligent Technologies with the aim of really doubling down on investments into cloud services and cybersecurity and related services around that. Now, to your point around growth, now, if you look at the recent market data, if you look at traditional telecoms connectivity services, you're looking at growth rates of, 3 to 6% compound annual growth rates. While if you look at cloud services, you know, the estimates from BMI is showing growth rates over the next 5 years of in excess of 15% compound annual growth rates. Similarly to cybersecurity, right? Cybersecurity growth rates over the next 5 years is estimated to be in excess of 12% across the market. So I guess the key question around that is how can we as a traditional telco player really position ourselves very quickly around the strengths of what we have and take an advantage of these growth pockets in our industry? And I do believe that with the transition and the transformations we've been driving in the business, that we are very well placed to seize those opportunities.
Yeah, in seizing some of these opportunities, you kind of have to know what the market looks like, and you continue to release some research as well regarding your cybersecurity threats as well in Africa. And I want to just touch on that very quickly as well before we go back a little bit to plans that you have for the entity. Are things getting a little bit too intricate when it comes to that cyberspace, that, you know, one, regulation doesn't catch up, two, that, you know, the general software companies and the telecoms companies are struggling to maybe catch up?
I think it's a very relevant question. You know, my personal assessment on our market situation is that we're finding ourselves with, you know, if you look at the last 20 years of company valuations, right? If you look at the different players, if you take, for example, telco players, traditional telco players providing connectivity, and you also add to that traditional software companies, and then you add on top of that the recent view of cloud services and the hyperscalers, as we would call them, for example, Facebook, Google, you know, Amazon, the new growing tech companies. If you look at the, you know, top four out of the top five global valued companies, four of the five of them are these tech giants, you know, and these guys are pouring billions of dollars into R&D, and they're doing it cloud-based, which means it's very easily accessible for companies nowadays to get access to the related cloud services. So I do believe that we're at a pivoting point in the industry where, you know, the software players traditionally potentially can get marginalized because it's very easy to actually get hold of these cloud services and to be honest with you, to integrate that back into your business. You know, traditional software has been quite cumbersome in terms of being able to deploy those services, integrate that into your environment, and sometimes very bespoke solutions, which means that if you want to add new services to it, it becomes very complex to deliver. While if you look at the promise of cloud services, you look at the very quick, fast integration once you have a base application of cloud services installed. And of course, if you really look at proper cloud services like the likes of Amazon, Google, and Microsoft, the likes of what they're offering you, it's really actually very easy to scale that. And of course, that comes with the promise of, you know, very good reliability. You know, they invest into the hardware infrastructure. They invest into resilience into their network. You know, and if one starts to then start adopting these technologies, it actually completely changes the way that you view your ICT investments.
That
is what excites me about the opportunity that we have as Liquid Intelligent Technologies, because, you know, from the study that you've referred to, right, we see a 96% increase in cloud services adoptions in the three key markets that we surveyed between South Africa, Kenya, and Zimbabwe. And we on purpose selected those three markets because we have huge presence in those markets. We're a very key player in those markets. And that gave us a real good sentiment recently of what the industry is saying about cloud services adoption. And, you know, maybe to the point as well, when I joined at the start of the year, you know, I've asked my team to, you know, get me 100 customer meetings. So I've literally met 100 top customers. As part of that dialogue, it was great for me to also get direct feedback from our customers about how they see their own journey in adopting into a cloud services strategy. And what is quite clear from all of them is, you know, cloud is becoming at the heart of their thinking of their future ICT strategy. And that is why I also know that our strategy is spot on, you know, because while people started with a piece of the puzzle, you know, they will more and more start looking at utilizing cloud services for various applications and start to think about and integrate the business benefits that will become.
Yeah.
And of course, that opens in the other theme of cybersecurity, which of course is a very interesting challenge. I mean, if you just look at the recent press of, you know, how many public listed companies in South Africa have been hit with cybersecurity related issues.
Even SOEs, right? We can go all the way to the likes of Transnet, which have certainly been hit too. Very quickly, though, on your side, Mr. Geyser, you have the repositioning, right, that you've noted and spoken about as well at length, even just today. Do you find that that's going to be something difficult? And I say because in this market, one needs to, I suppose, bang the drum consistently in order for people to kind of get the message most times. And to reposition as Liquid Intelligent Technologies and not knowing exactly perhaps what is offered on that basis is going to be a huge educational phase, not just for investors, but certainly for consumers too. How do you plan on doing that rollout? And how long do you think it takes before the take-up and the catch latches on?
I think very, very good questions. Maybe if I can give you a couple of, key pieces in our thinking and in my own thinking. You know, what for me is a key pillar that, I don't want to say is guaranteeing our success, but for sure is guaranteeing our growth, is that if you look at our cloud business as an example, you know, our cloud business grew 4x last year. And it's because of the fact that we invested pre-COVID times, you know, we were an early adopter to actually consider the strategic relationships with the larger hyperscalers in bringing their technologies not only into South Africa, but also with our data center assets that we have across South Africa and across the continent. You know, we have three very large data centers through our sister company, Africa Data Centers in the continent. You know, in South Africa, we've got three, in Kenya, we've got two, and we have major expansions planned around that. But what was quite clear for us is that our multinational ability from a business, we could see the trend coming, and we took an early adopter view of investing heavily with our partners into building the base for cloud services. And what was quite clear through the pandemic is that, you know, this 4x plus growth really have put that business of us, I almost want to say, on the cards for exponential growth. And we could learn a lot from that. Now, what we had to do in order to really transition from Liquid Telecoms to Liquid Intelligent Technologies is not only a rebrand and new logo, which I quite like. It has actually been to really look at our operating model and our capability in the company. So from the middle of last year, we actually went through quite a tough transition of doing a proper skill analysis of our team. And unfortunately, we had to take out some of the people that did not fit our future skill. And since the start of this year, we actually went on quite a large hiring spree for bringing in, you know, industry experts across the industry from, you know, a number of larger system integrators, integrated companies, like, for example, head of our cloud services in South Africa. He's an ex-IBM colleague. You know, someone that's a lady that's running my customer experience program is an ex-Altron colleague. You know, we've really gone into the market to find the best skill that will help us to think more like a system integrator than actually a telco.
Yeah, sure.
And we have to take that tough decision, which, you know, in the short term is always a tough decision to take a very deep view on where you want to be. But in the long term, in the medium and long term, it generates value. Yeah. And therefore, if you look at, for example, at our executive team layer, our senior management layer, we've had to take, you know, a very deep view around how do we drive this transformation. And we pretty much put in certain key areas a new leadership team and new leadership capabilities. And we've hired an, extreme skill. If I take our head of cybersecurity that recently joined the team, he's probably one of the top five guys in the country when it comes to cybersecurity.
Sure. Well, look, I want to unpack that leadership segment just a little bit more in a moment or two. We just need to head off just a little bit now, but we're going to continue this conversation. Of course, we are having our shapeshifter conversation. Dion Geyser is the CEO of what was formerly known as Liquid Telecom, but now repositioning as Liquid Intelligent Technologies. Back with this conversation right after this.
The Money Show is brought to you by APSA Access, an award-winning secure single sign-on platform that lets you manage your finances with speed and intelligence. That's Africanacity. APSA is a registered FSP.
The Money Show.
Shapeshifters.
A few more minutes till the top of the hour. We're still joined by Dion Geyser, who is the CEO of Liquid Intelligent Technologies, as we talk shapeshifters this evening. Formerly Liquid Telecom is the entity. Dion, before the break, we were talking about leadership and just how that is going to help you shape the business a little bit better and head in the right direction. You can have a vision all you want, but if you don't have the right people in place to help you execute it, you're basically rowing up a stream and, you know, pretty much without a paddle.
I fully subscribe to that. And, you know, what's been key for us on our journey to pivoting has actually been the principle of having the right people and being able to put the right operating model on top of that. You know, to transform a company, as you know, probably it's not as easy as just clicking your fingers and we're going to go from A to B. It literally is a journey. So what we've had to do from the outset of the journey is, you know, outside of a transformation of assessing skills, changing people, has been to put our customers at the heart of our business. Number two has been to really take a tough look at our operating capability and where we would like to be and drive a sharp increase in our operational efficiency as well as our operational excellence. And thirdly, is to deal with culture in our business. You know, traditional telcos don't always have the mindset of putting customers at the heart of their business. It's not driven around, you know, being able to listen to one unique customer's needs. And it's been really one of the key aspects of what we're trying to drive in our business is being able to, you know, have dialogues with our leading customers and really take to heart what they're asking us to do and to deliver and to be able to deliver on that very quickly. And that, of course, needs that right culture framework. So we've been spending a lot of time on those three aspects the last several months outside of, you know, just the basic of operations. But so far, to be honest with you, the fruit is there. You know, we're starting to see the first signs of that. You know, our customers are responding extremely well to our new brand and our repositioning. They're telling us that we're at the sweet spot of where they want to go to themselves. We have some really interesting orders that have come into the business recently, which customers are saying, but hey, I've been a traditional partner of yours in pure connectivity, but I will trust you with a bigger part of my spend, and I will trust you for the transformation journey that I'm going to go into. So it's really good to see how the market is actually reacting based on our repositioning and the capability that we built.
Yeah, and it's also going to then require you to perhaps spend a little bit more when it comes to things like infrastructure, right? And create the kind of network you probably need. How significant would the release of spectrum also be for yourselves as a business? Would that be helpful to your cause?
Look, I think if I can answer that question, maybe firstly is that, you know, as Liquid Intelligent Technologies, we've invested heavily the last number of years. And as I mentioned to you, our data center expansion through our sister company, ADC, we've just at the start of the year finished a mega fiber build between Cape Town to Durban, what we call NLD 5 and 6, you know, unlocking these tier two coastal towns to get proper access to fiber, which we believe will be a game changer in terms of infrastructure development in these tier two towns, you know, that's on the coast. But I mean, going forward, to your point, you know, our investment focus very much is around how do we expand our network where we need it to be, but adding on top of that, you know, not only the skill capability and the people capability, but for example, around cybersecurity, you know, what are the products and services and solutioning that we require in order to fulfill our customer asks and our customer demands. You know, we do see that there is, you know, more and more a need that, you know, we will be investing more into tech and the related capabilities, you know, at the same time, while we are transforming our customers' networks and our customer businesses, we are doing the same internally in our business. So we're taking an increased investment in our view around, you know, how do we actually prepare ourselves in our own business to automate more, you know, invest more into AI, you know, into analytics and related technologies. You know, we have to eat our own lunch that we sell as well. And that's what I think really helps us and sets us apart, you know, from other players, with the ability that we are eating our own lunch. We are building those technologies ourselves and we're selling them onto the market. And I don't think that that will change. I think that will actually just increase in the coming years. And then to relate that back to the spectrum piece, you know, I think as liquid intelligent technology, you know, we have a very juicy set of 5G spectrum. And we do see a rise with, you know, the 4IR theme in the country. You know, we have the ability to offer 5G related services that actually talks to the required applications needed for the future of our industry.
Yeah.
But having said that, you know, I've been very vocal around it, that we are very pro the spectrum auction. You know, spectrum in this country have been locked up for far too long. And as, you know, a large player in both fiber as well as wireless assets, you know, we do believe that it's good for the country to get that spectrum actually released.
100%.
And we're hopeful that the work that the regulator as well as the ministry is doing and the new minister herself is doing will actually be able to support us to get that released very quickly.
Yeah.
So we're hopeful that will get that impasse will get resolved soon.
The sooner the better is definitely one way to put it.
Absolutely.
Dion, thank you. Thank you. Really, really appreciate the time this evening having joined us to be our shapeshifter guest. Dion Reiser, the CEO of Liquid Intelligent Technologies, LIT. Clearly, it's going to get, as the younger ones say, lit in your business over the next couple of years. And all the best to you, Dion. So really, really appreciate it as well then this evening. That does bring an end to the show this evening as well. Thank you so much for joining us. We're back with you, of course, again tomorrow evening.